After the first day, the islander ceased to pay much attention when the official car murmured past on its sightseeing tours. The visitor's correct name, Thanthal Teresco, proved too intractable for general use, and he was soon christened the Inspector. It was an accurate enough name, for his curiosity and appetite for statistics were insatiable. Charles Jansen was quite exhausted when, long after midnight, he had seen the Inspector back to the flyer which was serving as his base. There, no doubt, he would continue to work throughout the night while his human hosts indulged in the frailty of sleep. Mrs. Sen greeted her husband anxiously on his return. They were a devoted couple, despite his playful habit of calling her Xantip when they were entertaining guests. She had long ago threatened to make the appropriate retort by brewing him a cup of hemlock, but fortunately this herbal beverage was less common to New Athens than the old. Was it a success? She asked as her husband settled down to a belated meal. I think so, but you can never tell what goes on inside those remarkable minds. He was certainly interested, even complimentary. I apologized, by the way, for not inviting him here. He said he quite understood, and had no wish to bang his head on our ceiling. What did you show him today? 138 The bread butter side of the colony, which he didn't seem to find as boring as I always do. He asked every question you could imagine about production, how we balanced our budget, our mineral resources, the birth rate, how we got our food, and so on. Luckily I had Secretary Harrison with me, and he'd come prepared with every annual report since the colony began. You should have heard them swapping statistics. The Inspector's borrowed a lot, and I'm prepared to bet that when we see him tomorrow he'll be able to quote any figure back at us. I find that kind of mental performance frightfully depressing. He yawned and began to peck half-heartedly at his food. Tomorrow should be more interesting. We're going to do the schools and the academy. That's when I'm going to ask some questions for a change. I'd like to know how the overlords bring up their kids. Assuming, of course, that they have any. That was not a question that Charles Sen was ever to have answered, but on other points the Inspector was remarkably talkative. He would evade awkward queries in a manner that was a pleasure to behold, and then, quite unexpectedly, would become positively confiding. Their first real intimacy occurred while they were driving away from the school that was one of the colony's chief prides. It's a great responsibility, Dr. Sen had remarked, training these young minds FTR the future. Fortunately, human beings are extraordinarily resilient. It takes a pretty bad upbringing to do permanent damage. Even if our aims are mistaken, our little victims will probably get over it. And as you've seen, they appear to be perfectly happy. He paused for a moment, then glanced mischievously up at the towering figure of his passenger. The Inspector was completely clothed in some reflecting silvery cloth so that not an inch of his body was exposed to the fierce sunlight. Behind the dark glasses, Dr. Sen was aware of the great eyes watching him emotionlessly, or with emotions which he could never understand. Our problem in bringing up these children must, I imagine, be very similar to yours when confronted with the human race. Wouldn't you agree? In some ways, admitted the Overlord gravely. In others, perhaps a better analogy can be found in the history of your colonial powers. The Roman and British empires, for that 139 reason, have always been of considerable interest to us. The case of India is particularly instructive. The main difference between us and the British in India was that they had no real motives for going the dot, no conscious objectives, that is, except such trivial and temporary ones as trade or hostility to other European powers. They found themselves possessors of an empire before they knew what to do with it, and were never really happy until they had got rid of it again. And will you, asked Dr. Sen, quite unable to resist the opportunity, get rid of your empire when the time arises? Without the slightest hesitation, replied the Inspector. Dr. Sen did not press the point. The forthrightness of the reply was not altogether flattering. Moreover, they had now arrived at the academy, where the assembled pedagogues were waiting to sharpen their wits on a real, live overlord. "As our distinguished colleague will have told you," said Professor Chance, Dean of the University of New Athens, "our main purpose is to keep the minds of our people alert, and to enable them to realize all their potentialities." Beyond the silent dot his gesture indicated, and rejected, the rest of the globe. I fear that the human race has lost its initiative. It has peace, it has plenty, but it has no horizons. "Yet here, of course," interjected the overlord blandly. Professor Chance, who lacked a sense of humor and was vaguely aware of the fact, glanced suspiciously at his visitor. "Here," he continued, "we do not suffer from the ancient obsession that leisure is wicked. But we do not consider that it is enough to be passive receptors of entertainment. Everybody on this island has one ambition, which may be summed up very simply. It is to do something, however small it may be, better than anyone else. Of course, it's an ideal we don't all achieve. But in this modern world, the great thing is to have an ideal. Achieving it is considerably less important." The inspector did not seem inclined to comment. He had discarded his protective clothing, but still wore dark glasses even in the subdued light of the common room. The dean wondered if they were physiologically necessary, or whether they were merely camouflage. Certainly they made quite impossible the already difficult task of reading the overlord's thoughts. He did not, however, seem to object to the some 140-watt challenging statements that had been thrown at him, or the criticisms of his race's policy with regard to Earth which they implied. The dean was about to press the attack when Professor Sperling, head of the science department, decided to make it a three-cornered fight. "As you doubtless know, sir, one of the great problems of our culture has been the dichotomy between art and science. I'd very much like to know your views on the matter. Do you subscribe to the view that all artists are abnormal? That their work, or at any rate the impulse behind it, is the result of some deep-seated psychological dissatisfaction?" Professor Chance cleared his throat purposefully, but the inspector forestalled him. "I've been told that all men are artists to a certain extent, so that everyone is capable of creating something, if only on a rudimentary level. At your schools yesterday, for example, I noticed the emphasis placed on self-expression in drawing, painting and modeling. Tilde the impulse seemed quite universal, even among those clearly destined to be specialists in science. So if all artists are abnormal, and all men are artists, we have an interesting syllogism." Everyone waited for him to complete it. But when it suited their purpose, the overlords could be impeccably tactful. The inspector came through the symphony concert with flying colors, which was a good deal more than could be said for many human members of the audience. The only concession to popular taste bad been Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms. The rest of the program was aggressively modernistic. Whatever one's views on its merits, the performance was superb, for the colony's boast that it possessed some of the finest musicians in the world was no idle one. There had been much wrangling among the various rival composers for the honor of being included in the program, though a few cynics wondered if it would be an honor at all. For all that anyone knew to the contrary, the overlords might be tone deaf. It was observed, however, that after the concert Thanthaltaresco sought out the three composers who had been present, and complimented them all on what he called their great 141 ingenuity. This caused them to retire with pleased but vaguely baffled expressions. It was not until the third day that George Gregson had a chance of meeting the inspector. The theatre had arranged a kind of mixed grill rather than a single dish. Act plays, a sketch by a world-famous impersonator, and a ballet sequence. Once again all these items were superbly executed in one critic's predicnon. Now at least we'll discover if the overlords can yawn. Was falsified. Indeed, the inspector laughed several times, and in the correct places. And yet, no, one could be sure. he might himself be putting on a superb act, following the performance by logic alone and with his own strange emotions completely untouched, as an anthropologist might take part in some primitive rite. The fact that he uttered the appropriate sounds, and made the expected responses, really proved nothing at all. Though George had been determined to have a talk with the inspector, he failed utterly. After the performance they exchanged a few words of introduction, then the visitor was swept away. It was completely impossible to isolate him from his entourage, and George went home in a state of extreme frustration. He was by no means certain what he wished to say even if he had had the chance. But somehow, he felt sure. He could have turned the conversation round to Jeff. And now the opportunity had gone. His bad temper lasted 2 days. The inspector's flyer had departed, amid many protestations of mutual regard, before the sequel emerged. No.1 had thought of questioning Jeff, and the boy must have been thinking it over for a long time before he approached George. "Daddy," he said, just prior to bedtime. "You know the overlord who came to see us?" "Yes," replied George grimly. "Well, he came to our school, and I heard him talk to some of the teachers. I didn't really understand what he said, but I think I recognized his voice. That's who told me to run when the big wave came." "You are quite sure?" Jeff hesitated for a moment. "Not quite, but if it wasn't him, it was another overlord. I wondered if I ought to thank him. But he's gone now, hasn't he?"
142 "Yes," said George. "I'm afraid he has. Still, perhaps we'll have another chance. Now go to bed like a good boy and don't worry about it anymore." When Jeff was safely out of the way, and Jenny had been attended to, Jean came back and sat on the rug beside George's chair, leaning against his legs. It was a habit that struck him as annoyingly sentimental, but not worth creating a fuss about. He merely made his knees as knobbly as possible. "What do you think about it now?" asked Jean in a tired, flat voice. "Do you believe it really happened?"
"It happened," George replied, "but perhaps we're foolish to worry. After all, most parents would be grateful. And of course, I am grateful. The explanation may be perfectly simple. We know that the overlords have got interested in the colony, so they've undoubtedly been observing it with their instruments. Despite that promise they made. Suppose one was just prowling round with that viewing gadget of theirs, and saw the wave coming? It would be natural enough to warn anyone who was in danger. But he knew Jeff's name, don't forget that. No, we're being watched. There's something peculiar about us, something that attracts their attention. I've felt it ever since Rupert's party. It's funny how that changed both our lives." George looked down at her with sympathy, but nothing more. It was strange how much one could alter in so short a time. He was fond of her, she had borne his children and was part of his life. But of the love which a not-clearly remembered person named George Gregson had once known towards a fading dream called Jean Morrell, how much remained? His love was divided now between Jeff and Jennifer on the one hand, and Carol on the other. He did not believe that Jean knew about Carol, and he intended to tell her before anyone else did. But somehow he had never got round to it. "Very well. Jeff is being watched. Protected, in fact. Don't you think that should make us proud? Perhaps the overlords have planned a great future for him. I wonder what it can be?" He was talking to reassure Jean, he knew. He was not greatly disturbed himself, only intrigued and baffled. And quite suddenly another thought struck him. Something that 143 should have occurred to him before. His eyes turned automatically towards the nursery. "I wonder if it's only Jeff thereafter," he said. In due course the inspector presented his report. The islanders would have given much to see it. All the statistics MD records went into the insatiable memories of the great imputers, which were some, but not all, of the unseen powers he and Care Ellen. even before these impersonal electric minds had arrived at their conclusions. However, the inspector had given his own recommendations. Expressed in the thoughts and language of the human race, they would have run as follows: we need take no action regarding the colony. It is an interesting experiment, but cannot in any way affect the future. Its artistic endeavors are no concern of ours, and there is no evidence that any scientific research is progressing along dangerous channels. As planned, I was able to see the school records of Subject Zero, without arousing curiosity. The relevant statistics are attached, and it will be seen that there are still no signs of any unusual development. Yet, as we know, breakthrough seldom gives much prior warning. I also met the subject's father, and gathered the impression that he wished to speak to me. Fortunately, I was able to avoid this. There is no doubt that he suspects something, though of course he can never guess the truth nor affect the outcome in any way. I grow more and more sorry for these people. George Gregson would have agreed with the inspector's verdict that there was nothing unusual about Jeff. There was just that one baffling incident, as startling as a single clap of thunder. On a long, calm day. And after that, nothing. Jeff had all the energy and inquisitiveness of any other 7-year-old. He was intelligent when he bothered to be, but was in no danger of becoming a genius. Sometimes, Gene thought a little wearily, he filled to perfection the classic recipe for a small boy, a noise surrounded by dirt. Not that it was very easy to be certain about the dirt, which had to accumulate 144 for a considerable time before it showed against Jeff's normal sunburn. By turns he could be affectionate or morose, reserved or ebullient. He showed no preference for one parent rather than the other, and the arrival of his little sister had not produced any signs of jealousy. His medical card was spotless. He had never had a day's illness in his life. But in these times, and in such a climate, there was nothing unusual about this. Unlike some boys, Jeff did not grow quickly bored by his father's company and desert him whenever possible for sedates of his own age. It was obvious that he shared George's artistic talents, and almost as soon as he was able to walk had become a regular backstage visitor to the colony's theater. Indeed, the theater had adopted him as an unofficial mascot, and he was now highly skilled at presenting bouquets to visiting celebrities of stage and screen. Yes, Jeff was a perfectly ordinary boy. So George reassured himself as they went for walks or rides together over the island's rather restricted terrain. They would talk as sons and fathers had done since the beginning of time, except that in this age there was so much more to talk about. Though Jeff never left the island, he could see all that he wished of the surrounding world through the ubiquitous eye of the television screen. He felt, like all the colonists, a slight disdain for the rest of mankind. They were the elite, the vanguard of progress. They would take mankind to the heights that the overlords had reached, and perhaps beyond. Not tomorrow, certainly, but today. They never guessed that that day would be all too soon. 18T Dreams began 6 weeks later. In the darkness of the sub-tropical night, George Gregson swam slowly upwards towards consciousness. He did not know what had awakened him, and for a moment he lay in a puzzled stupor. Then he realized that he was alone. Jean had got up and gone silently into the nursery. She was talking quietly to Jeff, too quietly for him to hear what she was saying. 145 George heaved himself out of bed and went to join her. The poppet had made such nocturnal excursions common enough, but then there had been no question of his remaining asleep through the uproar. This was something quite different, and he wondered what had disturbed Jean. The only light in the nursery came from the fluoro-dot paint patterns on the walls. By their dim glow, George could see Jean sitting beside Jeff's bed. She turned as he came in, and whispered, "Don't disturb the poppet." "What's the matter?" "I knew that Jeff wanted me, and that woke me up." The very matter-of-fact simplicity of that statement gave George a feeling of sick apprehension.
I knew that Jeff wanted me.
How did you know? He wondered.
But all he asked was, has he been having nightmares?
I'm not sure, said Jean, he seems all right now.
But he was frightened when I came in.
I wasn't frightened, Mummy, came a small, indignant voice.
But it was such a strange place.
What was?
Asked George.
Tell me all about it.
There were mountains, said Jeff dreamily.
They were ever so high and there was no snow on them, like on all the mountains I've ever seen.
Some of them were burning.
You mean dot volcanoes?
Not really.
They were burning all over, with funny blue flames.
And while I was watching, the sun came up.
Go on, dot, why have you stopped?
Jeff turned puzzled eyes towards his father.
That's the other thing I don't understand, Daddy.
It came up so quickly, and it was much too big.
And dot, it wasn't the right color.
It was such a pretty blue.
There was a long, heart dot freezing silence.
Then George said quietly, is that all?
Yes.
I began to feel kind of lonely, and that's when Mummy came and woke me up.
George tousled his son's untidy hair with one hand, while tightening his dressing dot gown around him with the other.
He felt suddenly very cold and very small.
But there was no hint of this in his voice when he spoke to Jeff.
It's just a silly dream, you've eaten too much for supper.
Forget all about it and go back to sleep, there's a good boy.
146 I will, Daddy, Jeff replied. He paused for a moment, then added thoughtfully, I think I'll try and go there again.
A blue sun?
Said Care Ellen, not many hours later.
That must have made identification fairly easy.
Yes, Rashavrak answered.
It is undoubtedly Fanidon too.
The Sulphur Mountains confirm the fact.
And it's interesting to notice the distortion of the time scale.
The planet rotates fairly slowly, so he must have observed many hours in a few minutes.
That's all you can discover?
Yes, without questioning the child directly.
We dare not do that.
Events must take their natural course without our interference.
When his parents approach us,
then, perhaps, we can question him.
They may never come to us.
And when they do, it may be too late.
That, I am afraid, cannot be helped.
We should never forget this fact, dot, that in these matters our curiosity is of no importance.
It is no more important, even, than the happiness of mankind.
His hand reached out to break the connection.
Continue the surveillance, of course, and report all results to me.
But do not interfere in any way.
Yet when he was awake, Jeff still seemed just the same.
That at least, thought George, was something for which they could be thankful.
But the dread was growing in his heart.
To Jeff it was only a game, it had not yet begun to frighten him.
A dream was merely a dream, no matter how strange it might be.
He was no longer lonely in the worlds that sleep opened up to him.
Only on that first night had his mind called out to Jean across whatever unknown gulfs had sundered them.
Now he went alone and fearless into the universe that was opening up before him.
In the mornings they would question him, and he would tell what he could remember.
Sometimes his words stumbled and failed as he tried to describe scenes which were clearly not only beyond all his experience, but beyond the imagination of man.
They would prompt him with new words, show him pictures 147 and colors to refresh his memory, then build up what pattern they could from his replies.
Often they could make nothing of the result, though it seemed that in Jeff's own mind his dream worlds were perfectly plain and sharp.
He was simply unable to communicate them to his parents.
Yet some were clear enough.
Space. No planet, no surrounding landscape, no world underfoot.
Only the stars in the velvet night, and hanging against them a great red sun that was beating like a heart.
Huge and tenuous at one moment, it would slowly shrink, brightening at the same time as if new fuel was being fed to its internal fires.
It would climb the spectrum and hover at the edge of yellow, and the cycle would reverse itself.
There, star would expand and cool, becoming once more a ragged, flame-red cloud. Typical pulsating variable, said Rashavarak eagerly. Scene 2, under tremendous time dot acceleration. I can't identify it precisely, but the nearest star that fits the description is Ramsandran 9. Or it may be Foranagon 12. Whichever it is, replied Kaer Ellen, he's getting further away from home. Much further, said Rashavarak. It might have been Earth. A white sun hung in a blue sky flecked with clouds, which were racing before a storm. A bill sloped gently down to an ocean torn into spray by the ravening wind. Yet nothing moved, the scene was frozen as if glimpsed in a flash of lightning. And far, far away on the horizon was something that was not of Earth. A line of misty columns, tapering slightly as they soared out of the sea and lost themselves among the clouds. They were spaced with perfect precision along the rim of the planet. Too huge to be artificial, yet too regular to be natural. Sidna as four and the pillars of the dawn, said Rashavarak, and there was awe in his voice. He has reached the center of the universe. And he has barely begun his journey, answered Kaer Ellen. 148. The planet was absolutely flat. Its enormous gravity had long ago crushed into one uniform level the mountains of its fiery youth. Mountains whose mightiest peaks had never exceeded a few meters in height. Yet there was life here, for the surface was covered with a myriad geometrical patterns that crawled and moved and changed their color. It was a world of two dimensions, inhabited by beings who could be no more than a fraction of a centimeter in thickness. And in its sky was such a sun as no opium eater could have imagined in his wildest dreams. Too hot to be white, it was a searing ghost at the frontiers of the ultra-violet, burning its planets with radiations which would be instantly lethal to all earthly forms of life. 4 millions of kilometers around extended great veils of gas and dust, fluorescing in countless colors as the blasts of ultra-violet tore through them. It was a star against which Earth's pale sun would have been as feeble as a glow-worm at noon. Hexanrax 2, and nowhere else in the known universe, said Rashavarak. Only a handful of our ships have ever reached it. And they have never risked any landings, for who would have thought that life could exist on such planets? It seems, said Kaer Ellen, that you scientists have not been as thorough as you had believed. If those patterns are intelligent, the problem of communication will be interesting. I wonder if they have any knowledge of the third dimension? It was a world that could never know the meaning of night and day, of years or seasons. Six colored suns shared its sky, so that there came only a change of light, never darkness. Through the clash and tug of conflicting gravitational fields, the planet traveled along the loops and curves of its inconceivably complex orbit, never retracing the same path. Ever, moment was unique, the configuration which the six suns now held in the heavens would not repeat itself this side of eternity. And even here there was life. Though the planet might be scorched by the central fires in one age, and frozen in the outer reaches in another, it was yet the home of intelligence. The great, many-faceted crystals stood grouped in intricate geometrical patterns, motionless in the eras of cold, growing slowly along the veins of mineral when the world was warm. 149 again. No matter if it took 1,000 years FBR them to complete a thought. The universe was still young, and time stretched endlessly before them. I have searched our records, said Rashavarak. We have no knowledge of such a world, or such a combination of suns. If it existed inside our universe, the astronomers would have detected it, even if it lay behind the range of our ships. Then he has left the galaxy, yes. Surely it cannot be much longer now. Who knows? He is only dreaming. When he awakes, he is still the same. It is merely the first phase. We will know soon enough when the change begins. We have met before, Mr. Gregson, said the Overlord gravely. My name is Rashavarak. No doubt you remember. Yes, said George. That party of Rupert Boyce's.
I am not likely to forget. And I thought we should meet again. Tell me, why have you asked FBR this interview? I think you already know. Perhaps, but it will help us both if you tell me in your own words.